you want to turn to Genesis chapter 47, we're coming to the conclusion of the book of Genesis, and we'll be beginning the book of Matthew when we finish this in just a few more weeks. So we look forward to that, beginning something new. But I guess in some ways it's not new, it's the same book. We're studying a different chapter of it, different section. Well, as Joseph's family has arrived in Egypt, and here they are, Joseph tells Pharaoh that they've come. They're in the land of Goshen, and someone asked me last night, I said, well, where is this land of Goshen? I thought they were in Egypt. Where's Goshen? If you know in general the idea of where Egypt is on the continent of Africa, on that eastern side, there is the, well, maybe I should do it over here so you can see it, is the area of Egypt, and the Nile River runs from the south up to the north. That's a little unusual to us because most of our rivers run from the north to the south here in the United States, or else they run a little east and west, but they kind of go in a southerly direction. But as the Nile River branches out into its delta before it pours into the Mediterranean Sea up there at the top of Egypt, there where that river branches, that delta area, is where the land of Goshen is. And it's on the eastern side of that delta area, and it's a very rich land. Of course, in the delta area, there was flooding a lot of times, and that would bring the silt and things, and we know about that a little bit living near the Mississippi River ourselves, that can make the farmland rich farmland, and it makes plants grow. And in fact, a few miles further east, as you got away from the Nile River, and I'm saying east my way of east, so if y'all want to see it, that way is east. But as you look a little further to the east on the map, you'll see that the plants die out, and then a little further over is desert area. So the land of Goshen was this region near the Nile River, but on the east side of the delta. So it was up near the Mediterranean Sea, and it was rich land. And then the city of Ramesses was located in that area as well. So right there by the delta of the Nile River is where we're talking about. Now, Egypt's a pretty big country, but we're talking about this just one small area is where Joseph's family settled, on the eastern side of the Nile River, up near the Mediterranean Sea. Probably some of the nicest weather, near the ocean, near the sea, and also near the river. Maybe they had a lot of mosquitoes too, though. So, but in an area where the farming could have been good, but also where there were lots of plants for the animals to eat, and not out in the desert area where they wouldn't have had anything. So that's where they are in Goshen. And Joseph only brings five of his brothers to meet Pharaoh. Don't know which ones or why only five. Maybe he didn't want to overwhelm Pharaoh. Maybe he picked the ones that he knew wouldn't say something stupid in front of Pharaoh and embarrass him. I don't know which ones he chose. But he picked five and brought them to Pharaoh. And Pharaoh asked them about their occupation. If you remember in the last chapter, he had coached them. Now, when he asks you, this is what you say. You tell him that you've been shepherds, that you've been about cattle, that that's what you do. You're herdsmen. You tell him that. And so sure enough, when he asks, they tell him that they're shepherds and their fathers were shepherds before them. For generations, this is a shepherding family. And they're all about cattle and livestock. And they explain that they have come to sojourn in the land. Now, they wind up staying there quite a long time. I don't know about you, but when I think about sojourning, I think about a fairly short stay. You know, maybe a few days or a week or two is sojourning. Maybe, some folks may sojourn. They sojourn down to the south in the wintertime for 2 or 3 months, and then they sojourn back up north in the summertime, something like that. We used to have those snowbirds, they would call them. They'd come down south for the winter and then go back up north. So maybe sojourning, maybe a few months, but they stayed there for generations. I don't know if you could really still consider that sojourning. They just decided to stay put once they got there, which is very different from what their ancestors had done. Abraham and Isaac traveled quite a bit. They were sojourners. They'd go here and they'd go there, and they'd only stay in one place for a little while, a few months, maybe a year or two or something like that, and then they'd travel on to another place. But here they are. They come and they settle here in this area. But they say that there are no pastures left in Canaan because of this famine that's happened. And now, I don't know if that's hyperbole, an exaggeration of the facts, or if really it had gotten that bad. It may have been so bad that there was not enough plant life in this famine, in this drought-type situation, that they could find food for their sheep and their cattle. So they asked to stay in that area of Goshen where we talked about a moment ago, where there would be some water from the nearby river and where there would be plants that would be available for them to have for their livestock. Verses 5 and 6, Pharaoh tells Joseph that they're to have the best land. He says, you give them the best of the land over there. And he also says, you know, if there's any of them that are really good at their job, if they're really good shepherds, if they're really good with livestock, then put them over my cattle. Put them in charge of mine. He's already very impressed with Joseph, and he thinks maybe there's somebody else in Joseph's family that can be as good with my livestock as Joseph's been with this famine thing. And so he wants to know if Joseph knows of any that are good to put them over there. Well, Joseph brings his father to see Pharaoh. And Jacob blesses Pharaoh. Now, that's been quite a while since we studied this, but if you remember back in when we studied about Abraham and Melchizedek, way back when, that's been quite some time ago. But back when we studied about Abraham and Melchizedek, we went over to Hebrews, because Hebrews is one place where we find out the most about this Melchizedek character, and we remember that Abraham was blessed by Melchizedek. And then we look to Hebrews chapter 7 and verse 7, and it says there that without contradiction, the less is blessed by the better, or the greater. And now we come here, as Jacob enters the land of Egypt, Jacob blesses Pharaoh. Now that tells us something about their relationship. Jacob was greater than Pharaoh. He was better than Pharaoh. Without contradiction, Hebrews said, the less is blessed by the greater. And so when Jacob blesses Pharaoh, that lets us know the position of these two individuals. Now, we need to understand what lesser and better are in this context. Lesser and better doesn't have to do with physical wealth. Pharaoh was far richer probably than Jacob was. Lesser and better, or greater, doesn't have to do with the number of people under their thumb or under their rule. Jacob was a family of 70 people. Pharaoh ran an entire nation. Now, what we've got to understand, and of course it didn't have anything to do with their physical physique, it wasn't that Jacob was stronger than Pharaoh. Now, what we've got to understand is, when the Bible talks about better, and less, and better, and greater, and worse, and those, it's always, well, maybe not always, but most of the time, 9 times out of 10, when the Bible's comparing things and says one is better than the other, it's looking at it in God's eyes. It's looking at it from a spiritual point of view, not a physical point of view. Certainly from a physical point of view, we say, well, here's this father of a family who's going to meet the king of a nation. Well, the king of the nation's better than... But not in God's eyes. Remember, Jacob is God's chosen one. He is Israel. He is the father of the entire nation of Israel, through whom God is going to bring, when we remember back to the promises all the way back to Abraham, God is going to bring the seed that is going to bless the entire world. Pharaoh may have, with the help of Joseph, saved the known world of his day and his region from a famine and physical death. But that's no comparison to what's going to happen as a result of one of the descendants of Jacob. One of Jacob's descendants is going to save the world, at least those who believe in him, as we studied this morning, from their sins. It's going to save them from spiritual death, which is a far greater thing. And so, clearly, in this respect, in the spiritual sense, Jacob was closer to God. Jacob was favored by God. He was chosen by God. In fact, God used Pharaoh and the entire nation of Egypt to save Jacob and his family. He didn't use Jacob and his family to save Egypt. That was just a byproduct. The fact that Egypt was saved by Joseph being there and being able to interpret the dreams and tell them of the famine and have the plan, the fact that Egypt was saved, that was just a byproduct. God wasn't out to save the land of Egypt. He was out to save Jacob and his family. The less is blessed by the greater. And in fact, down in verse 10, Jacob blesses Pharaoh a second time before he leaves. Well, in verses 8 and 9, Pharaoh asks how old Jacob is. And at this point, Jacob says he's 130 years old and he's had a tough life. He says, the days of my life have been evil. It's been bad. He's had a lot of rough times, Jacob has. You know, he was a trickster back in the beginning, and his brother wanted to kill him, so he had to run away from home, and his mother died while he was gone, and then he came back, and he winds up getting tricked, winds up with a wife he doesn't want, and winds up with four wives, and that's enough to ruin any man, I think. One's all most men should ever think about trying to handle, and so he has four of them, and then some Rachel dies, and his father dies, and he thought he lost Joseph, and he thought he lost Simeon, and he's had some rough times, but things are looking up now. But he says he hadn't lived as long as his fathers did. In fact, of course, this fits with the Bible description of the shortening lifespans after the flood. He's only lived 130 years, whereas people like Shem live well into their 800s and on, up to 900 even, back right after the flood. And yet it continues to get shorter as we go generations down. It's interesting that this event, just kind of thrown in, and you say, well, why would Pharaoh ask him how old he is? What difference does that make? Why would Jacob answer this question? Why is that even in there? Why did God think that was important to put in the Bible? It's an interesting benchmark. When we look at and trace the history of the Bible and the history of the world and the age of the world, and we studied that back in chapter 5 and we had that handout on the age of the world according to the Bible, and this is an interesting benchmark that helps us to get from where we are now back to, we go back to Solomon, and it tells then Solomon's temple was built a certain number of years after the children of Israel came into Egypt, which is right here. And then we know that Jacob was 130 years old at that time. And then we can trace that back to Isaac and back to Abraham and then go on. And so it gives us a benchmark. It helps us to get pretty close on determining the age that the Bible gives for the earth. In verse number 11, Joseph gets his family settled in the best of the land. And in verse 11, it's referred to as the land of Ramesses. And so this gives us another idea about where this land is. The land of Goshen. The land of Ramesses. The city of Ramesses was built right near that eastern branch, if you will, of the Delta area. And so the land of Goshen was surrounding that city of Ramesses, or the land of Ramesses as it's called here as well. And of course, if you looked on a map, you'll be able to see where that delta splits out and makes that triangle up toward the coast on the northern part of the land of Egypt. And you'll be able to see on the right side of that. It won't be marked on most of the maps. I had difficulty finding a map that had it marked, but most of the ones that I did find, that's where they had it shown to have been. That area was where the city of Ramesses has been located. In verse 12, we see that Joseph continues to feed his family in spite of the famine. The famine continues. And he said there were still going to be 5 more years of this thing. The famine continues on, and it gets worse and it gets worse. There's a lot of suffering going on. The land of Canaan takes it really hard. Nobody in Canaan really prepared for it, whereas Egypt was prepared for it. And it's good that Jacob and his family are down there in Egypt being cared for. They might not have survived. Many probably did not survive this famine for 7 years. That's a long famine to survive. Probably some skinny people that did survive at the end of it. Verse 14, though, we see that all of the people of Egypt have spent all their money to buy food from Joseph. They spent it all. I don't know how much they had, but it's all gone now. They spent everything they had. You know, it's interesting as we look at these events that are taking place here, and we're going to see the way that this government works and the way that these things took place. God doesn't condemn any of these things. Now, He doesn't, you know, say this is the way countries should be run or anything like that either. But one of the things that we notice throughout the Bible is God really spends very little time being concerned with politics. He really doesn't care about the political system of a country. He didn't care that the Roman Empire was an empire under an autocratic ruler when Jesus was born. That didn't matter. It didn't stop him from doing what he was going to do. You know, it didn't matter to him that Babylon had a king that was crazy in many ways, or for that matter, the king in the times of Esther. None of those things mattered to him. He had his plan, and he worked his plan, regardless of what the people in their nations did. Sometimes we get the mistaken idea that we're supposed to spread democracy and political freedom throughout the world. Now, I'm not against democracy and political freedom for people, not at all. But that's not our goal. Our goal is to spread the gospel. Our goal is to spread freedom from sin, not freedom from Satan, not necessarily political freedom. The Christians in the first century, they died because they were Christian. They were persecuted to death. And yet, they didn't rise up and call for an overthrow of the Roman government. Instead, Paul said, you subject yourselves to those governing authorities. Even a government that's putting Christians to death, yeah. As long as you can do so without violating the will of God, you do that. And so sometimes the Christian people will go and as missionaries into these nations, and they'll start trying to get the people stirred up to cause some sort of uprising to overthrow the government, to bring about democracy. And that's not what Christianity is about. Christianity is about bringing freedom from sin. Again, it'd be wonderful if every country in the world had freedom. That'd be great. But that's not what God put the church here to do. And we need to keep in mind where our goals have to be and where we put our energy. It'd be nice, but it doesn't have to be that way for God to work. In fact, sometimes God works even greater in those places where there's not religious and political freedom than He does in some places where there is. Sometimes here in America, where we have all this freedom religiously and politically, what we wind up with is the freedom to be apathetic. And maybe we need to take the A off of that, the freedom to just be pathetic sometimes. You know, we just sit around and do nothing. We forget that we're in a war. Satan's fighting against us, and we're supposed to be fighting against him. And we need to keep in mind what the purpose of the church is. Jesus came to seek and save the lost, not to set people free from political oppression. And so we need to keep that in mind. And so God doesn't condemn the fact that Pharaoh is an authoritarian regime, that he's an autocrat. That he drives a hard bargain with these folks. Remember, he told Joseph, when he put Joseph in that position, he said, hey, nobody in the land of Egypt's going to be able to take a breath or take a step without your permission. That's the kind of absolute power that he had. And even under those circumstances, God's able to work. Of course, to us here in America, these things may seem, wow, this is harsh what happens here. But it was reality. This is what did happen. As they ran out of money, and it's interesting, you know, you think about what's happened here. For 7 years, the people farmed their land. And Joseph and Pharaoh taxed them 20%. A 20% cut of all of their crops was taken by the government. So now here we are, 9 years after that began, into the third year of the famine or so. Now the people are growing, trying to grow their crops, and they're not growing. There's a famine. They're not, the crops are just not doing what they ought to do. And so they need food. And so now the government is going to sell back to these people their own food that it taxed them several years earlier. Well, that's quite a scheme. I really wish I could come up with a money-making scheme like that, where I take money away from somebody and then charge them to give it back to them. I guess banks kind of do that, don't they? That's the scheme that Joseph had set up with Pharaoh here. They taxed the people, gathered it all together, and then when the people got hungry, they sold it back to them. Sold the people back the thing that they had labored to produce in the first place. Oh, in America, we kind of get mad about that, don't we? We get mad at government doing things like that. Maybe not too awful mad, because it keeps happening, I guess, even here in America, where we have the freedom to vote people out. But of course, the people of Egypt couldn't vote. They just had to pay the price. Hey, it's kind of surprising, you know, it's almost surprising that there wasn't some sort of a revolt, that there wasn't a rebellion, that they didn't just storm the storehouses and you know, raid them, and you know, it could have been a disastrous situation. But the people remained calm, and they gladly paid every penny they had. Well, I don't guess they used pennies in Egypt, but whatever the monetary system was, they gave all their money, and so now they're out of their money, and now they come begging for food. They can't buy any with money, and so down in verse number 16, Joseph says, well, we'll take your cattle in exchange for some food. So he winds up with all their cattle, all their livestock, every single bit of it. And so they do that, and so he gives them food. That carries them over another year or so, and then guess what? They're back again. And they said, well, look, you got all our money, you got all our cattle, we got nothing left but us and our land. And so you know what? Joseph says, okay, we'll take that too. And so he takes the land, and he moves the people into cities, confiscates all their land, and gives them food. This is, you know, kind of the way a welfare-type system works. You know, a communistic-type system, where the government owns everything and give everything. I guess it's more socialism than communism. But you know, the government takes everything and gives a little out here and there where they think it's best to give it. And of course, like with any of that kind of government, there are those who are special. Joseph's family, for example. I mean, Joseph didn't take his family's money. He didn't take their cattle. He didn't take their land. Now, that could certainly cause some jealousy and some envy to see, well, yeah, they're over there living on that land. They got their cattle still. They got their money still. And we got nothing. Kind of wonder, but what this might have led to some of those hard feelings that rear their ugly head later on in Exodus, when the people of Egypt decide to make the children of Israel their slaves. Wonder if this favoritism that they're receiving now may have come home to roost, so to speak. But they've got the people all moved up. They've got everybody in the cities. Now, the religious leaders too, the priests, and it's kind of interesting if you ever study about Egypt, each Pharaoh had his favorite of the gods. There were lots of different gods, you know, but each Pharaoh had his favorite ones that he worshipped. And so those priests that served those particular gods, false gods, of course, the priests that served them, they got special treatment from the throne. And so the priests that were in favor by this Pharaoh, well, they didn't get their land confiscated, and Pharaoh fed them, made sure they were taken care of. They were exempted. But down in verse 23, Joseph reminds the people basically that they're slaves, that he owns them, and that he owns their land, and then he gives them some seed to go back and farm the land, and he makes a permanent arrangement with them to give them the seed. If they'll give 20%, they'll give that one-fifth back to Pharaoh, and then of the rest that's left, they can feed their families, and they can plant seed the next year and continue the crops growing. Well, they gladly trade their freedom to serve Pharaoh. You know, really, the idea of freedom that we have in this country is a pretty rare thing. But you know, how easy would it be to give up our freedom to save our lives? A lot of people do. A lot of people give up their freedom. I know we have, you know, live free or die and things like that. But that's unusual. Most places, most people, and you know, sad to say, here in America, we're going in that direction too, where we gladly give up our freedoms for a little bit of security. Well, we'll give up our freedom if you'll take care of us. That's kind of where the welfare state has led us in our country. The government will just take care of me, I'll give up my freedoms. You know, that's why a lot of people are enslaved to Satan and sin, too. They think that somehow Satan's taking care of them. They think that their crooked dealings and their sinful behavior is what's taking care of them. And they don't realize that they've given up their freedom to live and to be free and to do what God wants them to do. And instead, they're enslaved to Satan and to sin. In fact, this law, where the 20% tax on everybody except the priest, continued down to the time that Moses wrote this, and he says it up till now, until this time, even, he says in verse number 26. So even as Moses is penning, if that was still the law in Egypt, that you give 20% back to Pharaoh, whoever the Pharaoh was would receive 20% of the goods and of the produce of the land and so forth. Well, then we see that Israel, well, both the man and the nation, so Jacob and his descendants, all lived and multiplied, and they had possessions while everybody else was struggling during this time. And that things went well with them. And they really did multiply. They multiplied tremendously. Because you have 70 people at this point. And within just about four generations of people, Moses was Levi's great-great-grandson on one side and great-grandson on the other. So we're only talking about four generations. Only a couple hundred years of time, this people went from being 70 people to being over 600,000 people when they left Egypt. That's multiplying. That's a lot of people. That is a lot of people. So they reproduced and refilled the earth as God had commanded. But now as we come to the close of this chapter, Jacob dies. It's time for the end of his life. Now he dies at 147. He had said that he wasn't living as long as his parents lived. He may have known that he wasn't going to make it. His father Isaac had lived to be 180. His grandfather Abraham had lived to be 175. But there's been this general decrease in ages. Isaac was kind of an exception to the rule. He actually outlived his father in terms of the number of years they lived. But that was the exception of the rule. It just continually dropped and dropped. But before he died, he called Joseph to him. And he made Joseph promise, don't bury me here in the land of Egypt. Take me back and bury me with my fathers. Bury me with Isaac and with Abraham. Now we know that when the spirit's gone, when the spirit's left the body is just a shell. It's going to return to dust, and we know that really it doesn't matter where that body is laid. And when the time of the resurrection comes, God will be able to find it and put it back. Take care of that. It won't matter whether it's here or there or yonder. It'll be okay. But we have to realize that Jacob didn't necessarily understand all of the things that we understand about the way things work. You know, sometimes we read about these people and we try to put our knowledge and our advancements and our understanding of things and our hundreds of more years of writing of God's Word that we've read and studied and learned about, and we try to put that back there on them. And that's really not fair. Jacob, we have to understand, Jacob had never read a single verse in the Bible. Because when Jacob lived, there was no Bible. The first books of the Bible, Genesis and Exodus, these books that are talking about his life, weren't written until hundreds of years after he was dead. And so he certainly couldn't read over in the New Testament about what's going to happen at the judgment day and the resurrection. And he didn't know that. And I said, well, yeah, but God spoke to them. Yeah, but we don't know what all God shared with them. God only told them what they needed to know, to do what he needed them to do and to be pleasing to him. He didn't necessarily tell them all of the things. In fact, as we've looked in Colossians, talks about the mystery of Christ that was hidden from all these generations. It's been hidden from all that time, and it's only been revealed by the apostles and prophets in the first century. So sometimes we look at the morals that are taught in the New Testament, and those doctrines that are taught in the New Testament, and we try to apply that back here to people like Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And we say, well, Jacob, why did Jacob have four wives? The New Testament tells us every husband should have his own wife and every wife should have her own husband. How come he had four wives? Well, that verse wasn't written until several thousand years after he was dead. You can't compare that to what he knew and what God told him. And so we have to beware of that. We have to be cautious as we read these things that happened thousands of years ago, not to try to impress on them the things that we know now. Now, there have been a lot of scientific advancements and a lot of knowledge and in not just the Bible that's been written, but in other areas as well. Can you imagine what Jacob would think if he saw a computer or a car? He wouldn't know what to make of something like that. He'd be scared to death of something. Like, what is that thing? Makes this real loud noise, and it doesn't have feet like a normal animal, but it kind of makes noises like an animal. What is that thing? He wouldn't know. He wouldn't understand it. And so we see these people who, they loved God, and they served God to the best of their knowledge and to the best of their ability, and to the best that God had revealed His will to them. But we remember that God had not revealed all of His will to those individuals. But I want us to think about it. As Jacob asks Joseph to take his body back and bury it. And I don't know why. I don't know if it was because he wanted the boys to remember their heritage and have to go back to that tomb and remember where that land was, where Abraham and Isaac and Sarah and Rebekah and where they were all buried. I don't know. I don't know if that's why. I don't know if he was afraid that, he didn't understand how death worked and thought, that he wouldn't be able to be with his fathers in the afterlife if he wasn't buried with them. I don't know. I don't know what his knowledge was or wasn't about that. But I want us to think about it from our own standpoint. Sometimes we're very scared to talk about death. But we've got to understand it's a natural thing. And unless the Lord returns again, every single one of us is going to have to face it. Why are we so afraid of it? Why can't we talk about it? We talk about all sorts of other things. We need to talk about that with our families. What do our loved ones want? What do we want our loved ones to do about our arrangements? How do we want it to be? Now, sometimes we're very uncomfortable talking about those things, but we need to take a lesson from Jacob here. Jacob was not afraid to tell Joseph, this is what I want you to do. When I die, and we're all going to die, when I die, this is how I want it to be done. This is what I want you to do about it. Otherwise, what winds up happening is people who are in the midst of sorrow and grief and are having a great deal of difficulty thinking straight at all because of the pain that they've experienced because of the loss of this loved one are having to make decisions about things, and they have no idea what they're doing. They have no idea, well, would Mama have wanted this song or that song at the funeral? You know what? And sometimes they let their guilt get the better of them, and they spend thousands of dollars. Craig says, we don't mind if they spend thousands of dollars. But they'll spend thousands of dollars more out of their guilt because, I wasn't there with Mama the last few days, and so I feel bad, so I'm going to put in an extra $1,000 to get that more expensive casket, or I'm going to spend $500 on flowers, and they do these things out of guilt and shame, when if we just talk together, like Jacob and Joseph did, it would make it so much easier for everybody involved. We don't want to talk about it. We want to pretend we're going to live forever. Well, we are going to live forever. But first, we're going to have to die. So we need to talk about it. Talk with our loved ones about what they want. Talk to our loved ones about what we want. Since we are going to have to die, we need to be prepared. The gospel is very clear. We must hear the word of God. We must believe in Jesus Christ as the Son of God. Believe the story of the gospel that He came and lived a perfect life and died, was buried, and rose again. We've got to repent of our sins, confess Him as the Christ, and be buried with Him in baptism. And then we've got to rise up and live a new life. We've got to continue to believe in Him and continue to repent of sin when it comes into our life and continue to confess Him day in and day out. Continue to live faithfully for Him until that time when either Jesus does return to take us home with Him or until that day that we die. And then if we've lived faithfully, we know that when He does return, we'll be with Him. You need to respond to the invitation tonight. Perhaps you haven't lived in such a way that you can die in peace knowing that you'll be with Jesus. Don't wait. Take care of it today. Make sure that you're right with God. If you need to respond, do so as we stand and as we sing.